Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It is Saturday, January 14th, 2012. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. As our regular listeners know, Lyndon LaRouche has been leading the charge to oust President Barack Obama from office as a British agent who has repeatedly demonstrated his contempt for the U.S. Constitution, even though he took an oath to uphold it. At present, Obama is involved on behalf of the British Empire in a campaign to provoke a war with Iran and Syria, the real targets of which are Russia and China, which would be a nuclear World War III. Now, the average American knows that Obama is bad, and many Americans are now beginning to become aware of the war danger, as well as the fact that our financial system is not only not recovering, but in a deepening collapse. But most Americans cling to the impotent belief that nothing can be done. They are too powerful. In the first segment of our program today, we'll speak with a man who does not think that way. And then in the second half of the program, we'll get a report on an earlier case in which a small number of individuals not only took on and defeated the British Empire, but drafted a constitution based on a principle which not only built our nation into the world's leading economic power, but would work today to create the basis for global prosperity. So first, I would like to welcome to the program a man who is taking on the British Empire, a leader of the taxi union in Florence, Italy, a political activist who's challenging the coup against his nation, which is run by agents of the British Empire in the form of Mario Draghi, the new head of the European Central Bank, and Mario Monti, who was imposed as a financial dictator of Italy by the City of London. Claudio Giudici is joining us from Florence, Italy, and we'll have a translation from Andrew Spanis, who is in Milan. So, Claudio, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Nice to meet you.
You have become a very famous man in the last weeks, a recognized figure for opposing the Euro coup against Italy, with major coverage in the press, including a television clip, which I think we're making available on our website, of you on a program watched by well over 1.5 million people. But why don't you begin by telling our listeners what has happened since you and your union of taxi drivers decided to organize opposition to the privatization of your work?
La domanda è se può dirci, dire a noi, ai nostri ascoltatori, cosa è successo da quando lei e i suoi gli altri tassisti avete cominciato a organizzare un'opposizione a quello che sta facendo il governo Monti.
Bene, cosa è successo? In sostanza il governo Monti è entrato in una fase di stallo sicuramente per quanto riguardano tutti i tentativi di liberalizzazione e privatizzazione da portare avanti in Italia.
So the Monti government has essentially been blocked. They're in a situation at an impasse for all of their attempts at privatizing and liberalizing, that is deregulating various sectors of the Italian economy.
In realtà siamo di fronte a un'escalation in merito alla nostra protesta che inizialmente si è concentrata nella creazione di un sistema informativo parallelo, concentrato sui social network, su dei volantinaggi, sul passaparola dei lavoratori. E poi è sfociato in un qualcosa di ad un livello superiore, cioè il coinvolgimento dei mass media fino ad arrivare alla pubblicazione della mia lettera sul Financial Times.
So we are currently in a phase of escalation of our protest, whereas it started out with leaflets, with working through social networks, with one-to-one communication. Now we've gone to a different level in the media, which began with the Financial Times in London publishing a letter that I wrote.
A sua volta la pubblicazione sul Financial Times ha comportato un'ulteriore salita di livello, perché poi vi è stato la cosa ha fatto un grande eco, ha avuto una grande eco e questo ha comportato che i mass media, quelli più commerciali, diciamo, ci coinvolgessero o mi coinvolgessero ancora più direttamente. Adesso vedremo se la cosa andrà avanti.
So after the Financial Times published this letter, then it went to another level because this had a great deal of resonance in Italy, and the media in Italy, the leading media in Italy, have then contacted me and involved me in both the print and on television, and now we'll see what happens next.
Let me ask you, Claudio, how did you define the issue that caused the response that you got?
And come ha definito la questione che ha poi provocato questa risposta?
No, non capisco la domanda, Andrew. Come?
In quale modo ha impostato la questione nella sua lettera o verso il pubblico? Perché c'è stata una risposta positiva o negativa a quello che hai fatto?
Allora, la risposta positiva deriva dall'aver denunciato il livello superiore verso cui i cittadini devono guardare quando si parla di liberalizzazioni e di privatizzazioni di una serie di settori. E abbiamo definito come strategica anche il tentativo di liberalizzazione del nostro settore e dei piccoli settori del commercio per l'intero mondo del lavoro. Addirittura abbiamo portato ad esempio, abbiamo paragonato la liberalizzazione dei lavoratori del settore taxi a quella dei minatori, allo scontro che ci fu tra la Thatcher e i minatori in Inghilterra o tra i controllori di volo e Reagan negli Stati Uniti.
So the response came in particular because we denounced and we pointed out the higher level that people have to think on when you consider what's happening, what the Monti government is trying to do. That is that any attempts at deregulation and privatization of various sectors of the economy, we define this as strategic for the economy as a whole and for the entire labor workforce. We compared this, for example, with the fight between Margaret Thatcher and the miners in the United Kingdom, or between Reagan and the air traffic controllers in the United States.
Ma abbiamo anche dato altri due significati al tentativo di liberalizzazione del nostro settore. Uno, un'operazione di distrazione di massa. Due, il tentativo di fare i soliti regali alle grosse compagnie, a quelli che noi definiamo gli squali della finanza.
And then there are two other things that we pointed out. One, we called this an operation of mass distraction. And secondly, we said that what this does is this is a way of giving entire sectors of the economy over to what we call the sharks of global finance, people who would come into these sectors and buy them up.
Fino ad arrivare a giovedì sera scorso, quando di fronte a una platea televisiva importantissima come quella a cui ho avuto modo di partecipare, ho detto chiaro e tondo che i cittadini in questo momento vengono distratti dal vero problema, dal vero tema, ossia quello della crisi del sistema bancario internazionale in cui l'Italia stessa è coinvolta e del tentativo di procrastinarlo portando avanti teorie liberiste, portando avanti le idee di Adam Smith piuttosto che ricorrere a quelle di Franklin Roosevelt e oggi di Lyndon LaRouche.
So this led to a situation where Thursday, just 2 days ago, I was on this national TV show, which you mentioned, and what I said is that people are being distracted from the real problem, that the real problem is the collapse of the international banking system, financial system, and the attempt to continue with free market policies, that is, with Adam Smith-style policies, instead of Franklin Roosevelt-style policies and those of Lyndon LaRouche.
Now, I saw the interview with you where you brought up the connection of Mario Draghi to the Britannia. Are people getting the idea that this is being imposed on Italy from the outside?
Io ho visto l'intervista dove ha fatto paragone tra Mario Monti e il Britannia. Le persone capiscono che queste cose vengono imposte all'Italia?
Non credo che capiscano l'intero processo, ma credo che lo intuiscano bene. Inizialmente vi è stato un approccio un po' di stomaco al fenomeno, ma ogni giorno che passa sembra che la mente delle persone si apra sempre di più a questo genere di comprensione.
I don't think that people understand the full process. I think they have somewhat of an inkling of it as time goes by. At the beginning, it's a very guttural response to the attacks on the labor force. But each day that goes by, I think people's minds are opening up to the higher level of what's going on.
Now, I saw also that there will be the government has agreed to a meeting with the taxi union, but that you're planning on going ahead with a major demonstration in Rome later this month. Could you tell us about that?
Ho visto anche che il governo ha accettato un incontro con il settore, con i tassisti, però anche che voi avete deciso di andare avanti con una grande dimostrazione a Roma più tardi questo mese. Ci può dire di questo?
Allora, martedì 17 alle ore 18 il governo incontrerà una nostra delegazione. Credo che le esternazioni che ho avuto modo di esporre giovedì sera di fronte a milioni di telespettatori italiani abbiano messo in grave difficoltà il governo. Citare Franklin Roosevelt, Glass-Steagall, Lyndon LaRouche, citare in modo negativo Mario Draghi, il Britannia, Mario Monti, parlare della crisi finanziaria e di un tentativo di distrarre la popolazione da questi problemi abbia in qualche modo innescato un processo che per il governo sarà difficile arrestare.
On Tuesday, the government will meet with a delegation of the taxi drivers. However, I think that the government is now in a difficult situation, because what I was able to say in front of millions of viewers on television the other night has had a very big impact. To speak about Glass-Steagall, Franklin Roosevelt, Lyndon LaRouche, to go after Monti and Draghi the way I did, I think that this has led to has triggered a process that is going to create great problems for this government.
La forza di queste idee, come dice LaRouche, la forza della ragione, la forza della verità, è incredibile e in questo momento è dimostrata da cosa? L'opinione pubblica accosta l'idea del tassista a un qualcosa di veramente negativo. Tuttavia, parlare di quelle idee in quel contesto sembra come dire aver ripulito completamente l'immagine che io in quel momento avevo, quella di un tassista, e aver aperto la mente delle persone. È evidente, non sono stato bravo io, ma erano potentissime quelle idee che loro hanno potuto toccare con mano.
So the strength of these ideas, the power of reason, as LaRouche has called it, is demonstrated by this, that the public opinion generally has had a very negative view of taxi drivers. They're seen as dishonest, not positive, not having a positive role in society. But the ability to go on to television and speak about these ideas, important ideas in this manner, has started to clean up this image and get this idea out of people's minds. And it's not me, it's not that I did something great, it's that there are powerful ideas which I was able to talk about, which has brought people's thinking to a different level.
Claudio, this is very important because this is one of the key points Mr. LaRouche has been making, that you have a bankrupt financial system that can only continue because of the fear of the population to speak of these things. For example, when you speak of Mario Draghi in Britannia, this is something which they've tried to keep out of the public discussion, and yet it's a fact. So are people now responding on this, these ideas on a higher level?
Quindi Claudio, una delle cose molto importanti appunto che dice Nino LaRouche è che questo sistema attualmente in bancarotta riesce ad andare avanti solo perché la gente ha paura di parlare di queste cose, quindi il fatto che lei ha parlato di Mario Draghi, del Britannia, queste cose, aiuta le persone poi a pensare a livello superiore?
Sicuramente, aiuta le persone, sì, a pensare ad un livello superiore, a concentrarsi sulle cose importanti. Sembra quasi che certe idee abbiano quasi una funzione magica, ossia far riaprire la mente di queste persone, toglierle da quella gabbia che soffoca i loro processi mentali e li fa concentrare su ciò che paradossalmente poi hanno sotto il loro naso tutti i giorni.
Yes, it definitely helps people to concentrate on what's really important. It seems that certain ideas are almost magical in the sense that it helps people get out of a cage, a mental cage that blocks their creative processes in their everyday life. And then now, being able to speak about this higher level, people are freed from this cage and become more effective in the way that they look at things.
You're listening to The LaRouche Show, and we're speaking with a leader of the movement in Italy, which has slowed down or even stopped the drive for privatization. It's Claudio Giudice, and we have another 10 or so minutes. I have another question for you, which I know a lot of Americans are wondering about. How do you get the courage to stand up and say things that other people have been afraid to say?
Altra domanda è, dove trovi il coraggio per alzarti e dire le cose che altri hanno paura di dire? Lui dice, secondo me questo è molto importante per gli americani.
Dove trovo il coraggio? Non ho riflettuto abbastanza a merito a questo tema. Mi rendo conto che giovedì sono riuscito a fare qualcosa di importante, controllando l'emotività, tirando fuori concetti importanti di fronte a un pubblico importante. Però in effetti mi dispiace di deludervi, ma non ho riflettuto abbastanza in merito a questo aspetto quasi di carattere interiore, proprio della mia sensibilità.
I must say that I haven't thought about it in that way. I realized that what I was able to do on Thursday was important, that I was not overwhelmed by the situation, that I was able to bring out important ideas in that situation for millions of people. But I don't want to disappoint you, but I must say that I haven't really reflected on this interior aspect of how I was able to do it, but more about the fact that I was able to do it.
Well, I think also the fact that somebody has to do it, that seems to be one of the problems, that people are waiting for someone else to do it.
Dice, e la questione importante è che qualcuno lo deve fare, e quindi abbiamo questo problema che altri aspettano che qualcuno lo faccia.
Credo che LaRouche veda le cose con molto tempo di anticipo rispetto agli altri, cioè vede il processo dall'inizio, nella sua evoluzione e alla fine. Probabilmente mi sono affidato completamente a ciò che lui ci sta dicendo da molto tempo e quindi mi dico il tempo che abbiamo davanti è veramente molto poco oramai, e forse non abbiamo veramente più niente da perdere, dobbiamo tirare fuori il coraggio e sfidare senza paura anche per la nostra vita, i nostri interessi, ciò che può essere fra virgolette conveniente, e sfidare un insieme di ingiustizie che vediamo avanti. Amelia Robinson più volte ci ha detto che se non combattiamo il male ne diventiamo complici. Forse è stato tutto questo.
One thing that I have done is, and that I recognize, is that Lyndon LaRouche has been able to see things and he's been telling us about these processes ahead of time. He's been seeing them from the beginning and how they develop and where they're going. And so I listened to what Lyndon LaRouche has been telling us, and I realized that we do not have a lot of time, and therefore, in a certain sense, we have nothing to lose. So we have to have the courage to challenge and change our own habits about what we're doing in order to fight, and to fight against injustice. Amelia Boynton Robinson has said often that either we fight evil or we become a part of it. And I think that by following these, listening to these people and following these ideas, that's what helps me, has helped me do this.
E poi un altro aspetto su cui rifletto in questo momento con voi è il sentirmi parte di una squadra che quasi ti blinda intorno, che ti protegge, e rappresentata da Andrew Spannaus, da Liliana Gorini, da Claudio Scelani, da Flavio Sabanelli, da Aureliano Ferri, da tutti questi amici con cui ti senti quasi indebito nel momento in cui ti si presenta un'occasione importante per trasferire le idee che con loro hai condiviso e che in quel momento devi riuscire a mettere in rete, altrimenti te stesso non sei stato funzionale al gioco della squadra.
Another aspect which I just thought of right now during our discussion is the sense of being part of a team that helps you, that protects you, that encourages you. For example, there are all the other people who I work with and discuss things with, such as Andrew Spanis, myself, or Claudio Celani, Liliana Gorini, Flavio, Aureliano Ferri, the people in Italy. These are all people in Italy involved in Movisol, in the organization, on the movement here in Italy. Since I feel a debt to these people, and therefore when I have the opportunity, I have to be able to transmit ideas and do things in an effective way. Otherwise, I'm not. I've been unable to do what we discuss among ourselves for in public for the population, which is what I really want to do.
You mentioned Mr. LaRouche's forecasting. One of the things he has been emphasizing is that the Euro system, as part of the transatlantic system, is dead. Last night, the report came out that Standard & Poor's had just downgraded the debt of France and Austria, among others. And so now we're seeing a spread of the collapse of the euro. To what extent are you involved in discussing the post-euro system, going back to the lira, national sovereignty, as opposed to this imperial demand for deregulation and austerity?
Quindi LaRouche fa varie appunto previsioni, analisi sull'economia. Una delle cose che sottolinea è la fine dell'euro, la morte dell'euro. Quindi la domanda è, c'è stato ieri questo declassamento da parte di Standard & Poor's, la domanda è fino a che punto tu discuti, fai parte di discussioni per un sistema dopo l'euro, cioè un ritorno alla lira, invece di continuare con questa politica di privatizzazione e di austerità?
Discutiamo sicuramente di questo aspetto. Più volte mi è capitato recentemente di intervenire durante trasmissioni radiofoniche, ma in realtà anche già un due o tre anni fa, in merito alla fallacia, diciamo, ontologica dell'euro, soprattutto nel momento in cui non rappresenta in realtà alcuna cultura, alcuna comunità di persone. E quindi questo è un tema su cui stiamo lavorando, stiamo cercando di seminare, e credo che in realtà al momento sia anche molto favorevole da parte del popolo italiano per comprendere questo aspetto.
We discuss this often. We discuss this often on radio shows or talking to other people. And actually, already two or three years ago, we talked about the ontological failure of the euro system, of the euro, because it does not represent a culture. It does not represent a community of people. This is an issue we have been working on, and I think that now actually is a time that is very open. The population is very open to being able to understand this point.
Non è un caso che il segretario del principale partito di maggioranza qui in Italia, persone che, come dice sempre La Rouche, cercano più il consenso che non la verità, proprio oggi abbia parlato di un problema per l'Italia che rappresentano sia l'euro che l'Europa.
Chi ha detto questo?
Alfano.
Alfano. Che ha detto euro e Europa, non ho capito, l'euro rappresenta un problema.
Sì, sia l'euro che l'Europa.
Okay. So today, in fact, there's the leader of a major political party, Berlusconi's party, actually. Surprisingly, just and this is to point out that there is a change going on in the population, and even in this case in the political institutions. A leader of this party named Alfano, he actually today came out and made a public statement about how the European Union are not positive for Italy. So this is a big change, and we see this is what I mean when I say that the time is ripe for people to understand the problem.
Well, Claudio, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us, and we'll make sure that your activity is covered on the La Rouche Pack website. I know it will be on Movisol. Do you have anything to say to the Americans who think that Obama may be too powerful to challenge?
Claudio, io ti ringrazio. Noi continueremo a seguirti e metteremo anche seguiremo le vostre attività sul nostro sito. So che sarà sul sito di Movisol. Hai qualcosa da dire agli americani, che magari qualche americano pensa che Obama sia troppo potente per poter sfidare?
No, sì, ho qualcosa da dire. Non esiste nessuno di troppo potente da poter sfidare se portiamo avanti la verità. La cosa più potente è questa verità, e quindi non esiste nessuno che possa sconfiggerla se si mette sui binari della menzogna, del comodo. La verità da questo punto di vista è indistruttibile. Magari ci vuole tempo per farla venire a galla, perché è come un corpo che si getta nell'acqua, va velocissimo a fondo e risale molto più lentamente. E quindi Obama non può essere più potente di questa legge naturale.
There is something I do want to say to the Americans, that no one is too powerful. No one is too powerful if we base our operations, our actions on truth, because the truth is powerful, and it's more powerful than any person. No one can defeat truth with lies or in any other way that goes against the truth, because the truth is actually indestructible. It may take some time, but in the long term, natural law will always win.
Claudio, molto grazie for joining us today, and Andrew, thank you very much also.
Thank you, molte grazie a voi. Nice to meet you.
Okay.
Arrivederci.
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 All right, ciao. Ciao.
Ciao.
Right, so now we'll turn to an example of this fight earlier, but Nancy, this is actually very interesting. I'd like your thoughts on some of what you just heard from Claudio.
Okay, well,
let me just say, this is Nancy Spanis, who's joining us now, longtime editor of Executive Intelligence Review, who's published numerous articles on credit policy, economics, and we'll be getting that in a second. But as a political leader in the United States, Nancy, a former candidate, must be heartening to hear this story coming out of Italy.
Absolutely, and not just because that's my son over there. One thing that I really want to underscore here is that the Italian organization of the LaRouche movement is probably can be counted in, I mean, they have members who are not active, but in terms of active members of Movimento Solidarietà, probably the people that Claudio Giudice mentioned, about 6 to 10, are active and not all of those full-time. And they have, through a combination of sustained work over, I believe, 10 years, with political institutions in particular, have succeeded in getting bills for Glass-Steagall into the Italian Parliament, and have spread the ideas and solutions of Lyndon LaRouche, and have therefore been positioned to do what I think Lynn has talked about us doing here for a long time, which is be there to act when the opportunity arises. And that's what happened in this case. A lot of preparation had been done. Things looked very discouraging in the sense that you have a very small group of people who are out there proselytizing and proselytizing. Then what happens is the institutions fall apart. In this case, the oligarchy comes in and mandates that the elected government be eliminated and a technocratic government be put in. And they move with a brutal program, and people, and we're in a position to seize an opportunity, which is what Giudice, in collaboration with the organization in Italy, did. And it took off. You can't predict what will take off.
What we can predict at this point is that Obama is not going to change his policy, and therefore we have the same opportunity in the United States.
We don't know what the particular opportunity will be. What we know is that every individual in this situation where they are and where they can go have to be in active mode, which will create the potential for us to move as that opportunity opens up. I mean, one of the major elements that LaRouche is emphasizing right now to create the potential for those opportunities is the candidates movement, the slate of six candidates, and the imminent potential for expanding that candidates movement so that we are in place to move on any opportunity to do something like what is happening in Italy, which is not only put out the solution and make the right demands, but, you know, have an explosion into someone being a folk hero the way Claudio Giudice now is for the moment.
we should note that on January 18th, Lyndon LaRouche will be giving his accurate State of the Union message, January 18th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on LaRouche PAC. And what Mr. LaRouche has been emphasizing, you mentioned the candidates movement through a series of discussions that he initiated last Sunday, discussions on how to move people around the idea of principles as opposed to party or anything less than that. And the principle that he's taken up is one that you've written on extensively going back to your work as an editor of the original Political Economy of the American Revolution book. So this question of national credit, of national banking, why don't you just give a sense of how at this moment, where we're hearing a lot of nonsense in the election campaign, how do we capture people's attention around this idea of credit policy?
Well, I think the way Lynn put it at one point recently is the place to start, which is that you don't have a future if you don't have a functioning physical economy. And in fact, if all people are talking about in the election campaign or anything else is money, debt, budgets, and the like, even jobs, qua jobs, they're not talking about the reality of a physical economy which is collapsing in its potential to support a future population. And that fundamental issue, he said, no matter what, you know, we're not going to survive unless this issue of a functioning physical economy that provides for a future, i.e. goes into a process of scientific and technological progress that can be defined very elaborately scientifically, but, you know, for summary purposes, put it that way, then we aren't going to have a society, no matter what. And no one is addressing that. And that cannot be dealt with without two immediate measures. The elimination of phony debt, gambling debt, which is done by Glass-Steagall with strictly according to what Franklin Roosevelt's administration put through in 1933. And number two, to then issue credit for an expansion of the economy in the deepest sense of scientific and technological progress. That credit requires a national credit system or national banking. Some people are surprised. Someone had just asked me this last week. Why? Because I referred to Alexander Hamilton's report on the National Bank as the second report on public credit. And they were surprised by that. But in fact, that's what Hamilton based his entire system on. What you're providing for in his organization of a constitutional economic system in the United States was that it formed the basis for credit for future advances in the productive powers of labor and the ability to support the economy. He understood that it was that quality of scientific and technological progress in the physical economy that, and through which is only done through advancing the productive powers of labor, creative mentation, is the only way that you have a future for the country.
Nancy, you took this up in an article you published in the EIR back on December 10th, 2010, A Matter of Principle, Alexander Hamilton's Economics Created Our Constitution, which I think anybody who's serious about saving the country and civilization should read. One of the things I liked about the article is that you constantly referred back to the idiotic populism, which we see, or the right-wing populism, left-wing populism, you know, the idea that government can't create wealth, government can't create anything, got to be all private sector. And you made the point that government can create capital in the form of credit for investment. Why do you think this is something, I mean, obviously the British don't like this, but why is this something that's so hard for Americans today?
I think it's a brainwashing process from the 1950s forward. You know, it's very interesting that to sometimes look back at the speeches and even in some cases the textbooks of people in the early 1950s before the money economy took over as thoroughly as it has today. And you see, even Samuelson, you know, the infamous Robert Samuelson, you know, wrote that the idea of having a federal balanced budget was a kooky idea, right? Because he understood, as people who were involved in the buildup of the economy that Franklin Roosevelt initiated and that took off during World War II out of necessity, that you need a capital budget. You need capital investment for the future. You're not going to go by and, you know, mete out penny for penny in terms of return on investment according to the market and progress. You can't do it. You have to have long-term investment, 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, 100 years, right, when you're talking about the space program. So this is it was ingrained in the American system under our best presidents, starting with Washington, John Quincy Adams, Lincoln, McKinley, FDR, that we were, the government's purpose was to advance the wealth, as according to the preamble of the Constitution, advance the welfare of the population for our posterity, and that this was going to involve a long-term commitment of resources to create. And if you were...
Nancy, when you say this, I was just thinking back to the response we saw to Lyndon LaRouche's conception of the Strategic Defense Initiative, that you invest in new physical principles for the defense sector, which actually are not limited to defense. And even at that time, if you look at Ronald Reagan's embrace of LaRouche's policy, you see today how far it's fallen in the last 30 years, where people today are arguing against investment in space, investment in new technologies, although Obama seems to like drones.
Yeah, right. Not because they're high technology, just because he thinks that he can avoid a body count, you know, on the part of Americans for the short term.
But you see how what you're saying in the brainwashing, it's gotten much more extreme even. The people who claim to be Reagan supporters would not adopt LaRouche's idea of the SDI today.
Yeah, they would not, because they've been, you know, LaRouche would probably present it as the generational question. I mean, the fact is that many, you know, a large portion, certainly of the current generation becoming adults, a huge portion, and even more of the one right after that, and a minimal, unfortunately, amount of people in our generation actually have a connection and have lived through physical economic progress. The last they saw was the space program, and it died, right? It was killed effectively after Kennedy was killed, even though we had the high moment under the Nixon administration, but it was no longer a national mission. It was no longer a commitment to the future, despite the fact that the Bushes, you know, said that they wanted to have a program for Mars and so forth. It was like a add-on to the 1,000 points of light or something. I don't know. You know, it was not a national mission for the country to which people would devote their intellectual and passion for what they would create. So because our people have been squished, they've been squished into a concept of simply surviving day to day with whatever they can grab or prevent being
good. Yeah, a lot of that is a form of consumerism, where the idea is that wealth gives you access to things that you want, as opposed to wealth representing a transformation of physical economic development. Nancy, what I'd like to do, we have about 15 minutes left, since this is the discussion topic that Lynn is putting on the table for the election, as with the six candidates, as a presidential slate to shape the debate, let's just start with the two points that you made as the basis of what has to be done. Glass-Steagall. We've talked about this a lot on this program, but I think it's still worth reiterating the importance of Glass-Steagall to clean up the mess. Go ahead.
All right. Well, you know, this idea has really taken root. We always opposed the elimination of Glass-Steagall, but it became a real rallying cry in the fall of 2008 for us. And at that point, people looked at us like, what's that? Now it's all over the place. It's even members of what you might consider the Austrian school of economics occasionally say we need Glass-Steagall. But what it is extremely simple. It was a 33-page bill, and you know the guts of it was much shorter than that. It said that you have to separate investment banking from commercial banking being the banking that supports your physical economy and people's living standard and investment for production, your investment banking being speculation and gambling. The problem we have with our banking system now is it is so contaminated by the deregulation that says that anything can be a bank. Remember the whole period of the bailout system in 2008 where, you know, and 2009 where everybody was coming in and saying, I'm a bank, give me money, you know.
Yeah, they gave charters immediately to Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley to save them.
Right. So everything was redefined as a bank, you know, so it could get a bailout. And that money was connected to nothing. I mean, the fundamental principle of the American Constitution and Hamiltonian economics is that money is related to a product, a productive purpose in the economy. And this money is basically money to cover gambling debts. And that's the first thing that has to be eliminated. So much debt has been created through that gambling process, the derivatives process, which we've discussed for a long, long time, the credit default swaps, et cetera, all these exotic, I guess what Greenspan would call creative finance. All of this has created an amount of debt that can never be paid. And that has to be recognized. Wipe it out. And that's the purpose. Then, you know, Glass-Steagall, as FDR did it, and FDR did it in two steps. FDR went in for an audit with the bank holiday, and then he had Glass-Steagall. But the same purpose can be accomplished by simply reimposing Glass-Steagall now. And that is what... Go ahead.
And then the second point that LaRouche is making is that once you do that, you'll find that there's not enough, quote-unquote, money in the system to start up productive investment again, and that's why you need national credit.
Right.
So we would immediately go with a national credit mechanism, a national bank, that would, and again, this goes back to the Hamiltonian principle.
Right. There, you know, what, well, two points I would make. One aspect of it that Mr. LaRouche made, I think, for the first time the other week when he was re-going through this policy of national banking and how you needed the national credit from a national banking system in order to restart the economy, was that the way most people would think of it is, well, if you're going to invest in NOAPA, for example, or high-speed rail around the United States, restoring our sewer systems and water systems, which are in many cases 100 to 150 years old and leaking more than they're delivering, most people would think, well, you need to get tax revenue for that, right? You've got to find a stash of money or a flow of money that you can collect and throw at it. And he said, that's not going to exist. It's not going to exist. Forget it. You have to issue credit. And how do you know that the credit will ever be repaid? You know it because you know the relationship between what you're investing in and an increased productivity of your economy down the line. There's a scientific basis for doing that. That's one of the reasons LaRouche says that he understands how to get out of this very severe crisis, a crisis worse than it was in the 30s, where other people don't, because he has an idea of what sectors of the economy will drive that increase in productivity, what we've often called a science driver, that other people do not. You know, it's a fun.
And also, he's written a number of papers recently where he addresses directly what Hamilton described, that you quote in your article, inventiveness or the power of the human mind.
Right.
That this is the real focus of an economy.
Right, absolutely. And the other aspect is what Hamilton did. I mean, what Hamilton did to create the National Bank was basically what I would call today a bankruptcy reorganization. He said, okay, we have all this debt, we can't possibly pay it off, and we're going to turn it into bonds, and we're going to put those bonds, you know, which are only going to pay interest, into a accumulation of capital, so-called, in the national banking system, and we're going to invest them. And then that bank is going to lend that money, he's going to monetize it, lend it to the private physical economy of the country. Not to the government, you know, to spend money, you know, to have new bureaucracies and so forth and so on, or to have wars. He was very concerned not to have a national banking system as a kitty for wars for the ruling class, which is what the British national banking system was, or, you know, independent central banking system was. Very concerned that the standard here for national banking was the increase in the physical productivity of manufacturers and agriculture in the United States. And that's the idea that we have to get across. It's actually so extremely simple. If people get the whole superstructure of money and investments and markets and video games, and, you know, one thing that really freaks me out, Harley, is that they now are so-called teaching economics in grade school and high school, you know, and you really have to fear for what it means when, you know, they're going to try to be brainwashing all these kids into becoming little, you know, hedge fund owners or something.
You know, I think this is why it was interesting to begin the program with Claudio Giudici, and the fact that one person who stood up on a matter of principle and told the truth has catalyzed a fight in Italy, which has forced the government of the European dictators to have to deal with this problem.
It's extremely interesting that they were so sensitive. Because, you know, what happened, actually, is that Monti declared this liberalization for this taxi sector and other sectors. I don't know how big the taxi union is nationally. I really don't. But
well, they claim they're going to bring 20,000 drivers to Rome on January 23rd.
Yeah, I know.
With their taxis, and given the situation with traffic in Rome, that might be very interesting.
Yeah. So they just put out a leaflet, right? And they put it in all the cabs, and they gave it to all their customers, right? And it became, and then they had a strike, right? A one-day strike. And that was the, you know, resulted in Monti pulling back for a minute. And for some reason, people at the Financial Times took notice of this. I mean, they did it in a sort of nasty way. Maybe they even did it because they're anti-Italian, you know, because they're racist bastards. Because they said, you know, Monti, who was able, who did work for Goldman Sachs, I think, also, who had bested Microsoft, you know, is being bested by the tax, you know, the lowly taxi workers. And having done that, having said something about that, then Giudici writes a letter, you know, and it takes off, right? But it's, they decided to fight. And you have to realize Italy is a country where you have massive trade unionism, much more than in the United States.
Well, it's also the third largest economy in Europe.
Right.
And that's quite significant. But I was also struck on the importance of the letter to the Financial Times, I was thinking back about Hamilton and the fact that when he first started advocating a national bank was during the Revolutionary War, and it was done, I believe, through letters to newspapers, wasn't it?
Well, yes, there were, well, a lot of personal letters and, yes, anonymous letters to newspapers. There was a whole war between him and the Tories in the 1770s because the Tories were trying to turn the countryside, the farmers, against the people in the cities, both trade people and artisans. And Hamilton was saying, no, no, no. I mean, the British were trying to do that, in fact, because they wanted to keep this a nation of service to the empire. And the only way they could do that is to prevent it from becoming a manufacturing nation, prevent it from becoming a unified nation. So, yes, he did a lot. This guy is probably as prolific, if not more prolific, than Lynn, although since he lived so many years less, Lynn will surely outdo him. But
well, I like the way Claudio put it in the beginning, where he basically said that you're dealing with a question of truth, and you never know when it's going to break through, but the power of truth is incredible.
Right.
And I think this is something we saw with Hamilton, who had to fight against Tories in his own delegation in New York State, who had to fight against the backward tendencies of the Virginian landowners, which you know quite well from having run for the governorship, right? Or the Senate, was it?
Both.
Both in Virginia. So, you know, this question then of the individual standing for truth, if you look at the legacy of Hamilton, this is something where the truth today of his work still comes through. And I think this is what Claudio was reflecting when he said, well, you know, gee, I didn't really think about it before. I'm just doing what I think is right.
Right.
And this is what you would expect to happen in the United States.
Right. And it's what has to happen in the United States right now. We saw it, I think, a little bit in the last campaigns of our younger members. They were very inspiring. Rachel Brown up against, you know, that Barney Frank and so forth. People were inspired by speaking truth to power, I guess, as they say. That's what we have to do multi-fold at the present
time. And
that's
time. That's the question of leadership, which Lynn is addressing in the work he's doing with the Slate.
Right, right.
Well, we have the webcast on January 18th. Again, I want to remind our listeners that will be before our next program. So write it down in your calendar now, January 18th, 8 p.m. Eastern Time.
Live.
Yes, live, 8 p.m. And, of course, it will be archived, but you miss something if you don't get it live. Nancy, anything else you want to add?
No, only that I would encourage everyone to go to the LaRouche Pub site, which I guess you're on if you're listening to this broadcast, and to go to the archive and get the Hamilton article. It was reposted on LPAC this last week, but I think it's no longer there because of other things coming on. There are very...
Well, this was December 10th, 2010.
10, yes. A matter of principle, Alexander Hamilton's economics created our Constitution. You know, people talk about the Constitution all the time. They don't understand it. They don't understand, and you can tell that by what they've done to our country. So go to the source, go to Hamilton's writings, go to LaRouche's writings, and we have very little time because, unfortunately, the thermonuclear war danger is still very much with us, and we need to get rid of Obama and get on to these principled solutions of bringing our country out of this mess and therefore helping places like Italy, which, to have a lasting success, need us to do our part.
So grab your friends and neighbors who think they're with Occupy Wall Street or the Tea Party or occupying the Tea Party or whatever, and give them something that actually works and get them to the LaRouchePAC.com website. Nancy, thank you very much for joining us today, and this has been another edition of the LaRouche Show. We will be back next week, next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern. And don't forget, January 18th, 8 p.m., Lyndon LaRouche's State of the Union Address.